Well, because the greater art form, which our other art forms are embodied within, is the making a masterpiece of our life.
Yes.
Me being an artist is just literally a reflection of the fact that what we are doing in life is taking this clay and we're making a life. We're making an art form as we go that we leave behind, and it's called a legacy.
Hello, and welcome to episode 36 of Attention Engineer. I'm Laura Kidd, a music producer, songwriter, and solo artist making music as Penfriend, and beaming into your ears from my studio, The Launchpad, in Bristol. You can find me around the internet by using the handle at PenFriendRocks most everywhere. Thank you for joining me today as I continue my mission to encourage creativity in every listener by sharing conversations with some of the artists I admire the most. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you're doing okay out there, wherever you are. I'm recording this greeting on the anniversary of the first UK lockdown, which is a pretty sobering thought. And I'm not quite sure what to make of it other than to just keep trying to keep trying, you know? This morning, the vinyl copies of my new record Exotic Monsters were delivered by a very bemused van driver who was interested to know exactly where in this small domestic abode all those boxes were going to go. Thank goodness for a living room and a patient husband. I suppose I won't be filming any more green screen videos in there for a while, but I will be making myself a cozy fort. If you'd like to help clear my home of vinyl, you can listen to some musical snippets and browse all the limited edition bundles at penfriend.rocks/new album. My new single Black Car is coming out this Friday, along with that video I was telling you about last week, so follow me on all the doobly-doos to get notified of that as well. To my incredibly exciting guest. Artist, composer, arranger, producer, multi-instrumentalist, entrepreneur, and post-millennium rocker Sananda Maitreya had his light switched on at the age of 2 by the music of the Beatles and has been a fool for music ever since. His debut solo album, Introducing the Hardline, was released in July 1987 under the name Terence Trent D'Arby, producing hits including If You Let Me Stay, Sign Your Name, Dance Little Sister, and the number one hit Wishing Well. And he's released 12 wide-ranging albums in the years since. As a survivor of a trauma that forced his hand into rebuilding his identity, Sananda once let go of a former life in order to dedicate his new personage to the pursuit of his true calling. It meant rejecting what fans and the industry had presumed would be his lifelong endeavour. But realising the dream inside was bigger than what the former life could accommodate, he pulled through the other side and found purpose. Never taking what he's fortunate to have for granted, new album Pandora's Playhouse pays homage to Sananda's inspirations, mentors, and family, all whilst recounting the lessons he has carried through one of the most unique careers in musical history. A once platinum-certified, multi-million-selling artist, Sananda's career could fill multiple lifetimes, and some would say it has. I have to tell you, talking to someone whose voice you've been listening to since you were a kid is surreal to say the least, but I kept it together and we had a really honest, warm and inspiring chat. In this conversation, we discuss making a masterpiece of your life, not just your art, letting go of an abusive past and learning to fly again, Sananda's relationship with his singing voice, the life of an artist, a career or a calling, the value of surrendering to the creative process and allowing it to surprise you, and making music that babies are conceived to. Is there any greater compliment for an artist? Just a note before we get started, Sananda does allude to an abusive past in the music business, but we don't go into details here, so I don't feel a content warning is needed. All right, I am so very delighted to share this conversation with you. Here we go. So do you find then that the separation between home and studio is important for your creation?
At this point, yeah. I mean, of course, our life and our process happens in stages and, you know, eras.
Yeah.
And as I was saying to you before, there is certainly a great excitement when you're younger in having a studio where you live. I mean, that's like the makes you, you know, does your place just one great, all-encompassing creative space. But like I said, after you kind of exhaust that and those possibilities, then of course the limitations then begin to become a bit more apparent. And you then begin to appreciate, you know, having a place where you can live your full creative life in that place, then lock the doors and, you know, go back to your other place where you assume your other identity, which is very important to allow yourself at some point as you progress as an artist to remember that you also have an obligation to yourself as just a person going through the changes of life.
That's so interesting. I heard Nick Cave talk about this on a podcast once about how he wanted to separate his family life from his recording because he didn't want to take all of that kind of darkness and stuff and have that around his kids all the time. So he would keep office hours in a different space.
I've always had great respect for Master Nick. So I'm sure he understands because he is also the type of artist who lives his artistic life completely and fully. And I can understand wanting to shield, you know, the sensitive people around him that he loves away from having to always be in the firing line of that type of intensity, because that's the fuel that certainly sparks his creation, all of our creation. So yes, at some point you do try to be responsible with that particular flame that it doesn't wind up burning or singeing anything unnecessarily.
Yeah. How are you so articulate so early in the morning?
It's called, I think it's called, it used to be called a Dutch breakfast.
What's that?
A Dutch breakfast is when you take a little bit of coffee in the morning and you have a little bit of marijuana.
Ah, that'll do it.
Now, that's called a Dutch breakfast because it was apparently popularized by Dutch students when they were in university studying. Because the one, of course, the Maria relaxes you and expands your focus, while the coffee basically tightens your focus and allows you to just. So I was kind of being somewhat facetious. It's just the fact that I always, as a father of two young boys, I think it's imperative upon me and responsible to just keep myself in as light a state of consciousness as possible.
That makes sense to me. I'm on the British breakfast, which is just a substandard coffee, but that'll do. That'll do. Now, I'd love it if you could introduce yourself for the listeners, because I feel like we can get really deep very quickly here. And I'd just love them to just hear from you how you introduce yourself to people. That's all right.
I actually haven't really tried to make it a habit to go around introducing myself to people, but
that's what everyone says, and I love that.
I'm an artist. My name is Ananda Maitreya, and I've been in one form or another making music since I was a child. Like many people who find themselves in my circumstances, I was considered a prodigy as a child, and then at some point, your next skill becomes protecting yourself from the people around you who see the gift that you have as something that they can exploit for their own continuance or for their own benefit. And eventually you wind up in an adulthood where you're still idealistic and not yet cynical and bitter enough to be able to share with people around you what you believe to be the magic of art and your ability to collaborate with it and perhaps cause some moments that might in fact benefit someone else's capacity for life in any way. And then next thing you know, you're kind of like going through this like very powerful and weird transformation after having been kicked off of Mount Olympus by the gods of Olympus for being perhaps a bit more than they were willing to absorb at the time. And then after that, you just wind up assuming another identity because some kind of rebirth has happened whereby you have to be in alignment with that life. And the next thing you know, the name is Ananda Maitreya, and you're talking to Laura on a on a cool podcast.
Yay. And Laura's pinching herself because she's been listening to you for many years. And so I was very interested to know about your voice, how you feel about your voice, because I know I've read about the metamorphosis you've gone through and all of that, and I fully respect that. If you're going to live a long life as an artist creating things, and you're going to go through various different stages and, you know, hopefully evolve through them, which I respect you for doing. But your voice, your inimitable voice, the voice that will be recognized by so many people. When I listen to your latest record, which is mind-blowing, and I listen to your earlier work, to me, the voice has obviously evolved, but the voice is the voice. You haven't changed your voice. And so some of the guests I've been talking to recently on this show, we've been talking about the voice as an essence or as a fingerprint or something like that. Something that's far more than me playing the same guitar as someone else. It's just so much more personal. So I was wondering what your relationship is with your voice.
To be quite honest, once I realized that it was something unique. And once I accepted that it was a gift from what my understanding of God is, I then developed a very respectful relationship with it whereby I pretty much leave it alone. I don't do anything to pamper it. I probably only even started wearing scarves in the last few years out of respect for the throat area. And I don't tend to listen to it a lot. I pretty much use it. I kind of have a relationship to it the way I would imagine young Arthur had to Excalibur. I was able to pull it out of the stone. And I understood that it was a very rare, wonderful thing to have a responsibility for. And like I said, I always saw it not necessarily as mine, but as something I were loaned by nature to do something with. So it's I don't really trouble it much. I don't bother it much. I'm careful to kind of keep my diet roughly to the things I think pleases the body, not just things that I think it should have, but things that it asks for, because I think the key to any relationship with a talent is to love and honor the body that carries that talent. So it's just a long-winded way of saying I have a great respect for it and appreciation for it. I don't see it as mine. I see it as something that belongs to time. And that I've pretty much been an energy that's wrapped around it. And I'm asked to work with it as a part of my karma. And that's pretty much it. I, you know, once I record my music and mix it, I don't listen to it again until I master it. And once I master it, it's done. And I really don't reapproach it. So it's a very respectful relationship, but I've always had a bit of a social distance relationship with it as well.
And does it ever surprise you still? Can it still surprise you?
Yes. It's not just the voice, though. It's the process. The process is still very surprising. And that's what the value of surrendering to your process is that when we insist that things continue along the lines that they've always gone for us, then we basically make surprise more of a challenge. Whereas when we just kind of accept that each time is just, can be its own unique experience, then there's just more room for the element of surprise to collaborate with your process and bring something to it. So it does surprise me as still at times, but it's also, there are times when I'm singing when that literally doesn't feel like I'm actually singing the voice, but that I'm just listening to a voice being sung. And that's, I'm sure there's some people who can visualize that, but there are still moments when I'm singing and it doesn't feel like me singing. It feels like me listening to somebody sing.
Yeah.
And I'm just that close to them. So, but the same thing still happens with me with any instrument that I'm playing, any song that I'm writing. I do try to live my life in such a way that spontaneity and surprise are as much a part of the regular program as can be made possible.
That's a lovely way of living life, I think. Do you think of yourself as a mindful person, or is that something you've worked at or evolved into?
It's something that ultimately, in its own way, is to be evolved out of, because I'm probably characterized by a mindfulness that then, like anything else, can become an albatross if you don't have the confidence to know when not to be mindful. That just because you are a mindful type doesn't mean that you are obliged to conform to every response in such a way. Because the balance of nature is still what we're looking for, regardless of what type of person that we are.
Mm.
So, you know, you lead with your dominant hand for a while until you realize the great value in bringing the other hand more into conscious play.
Mm-hmm.
And in so doing, you then see the benefit to your whole way of expression, your whole way of being, your whole way of perceiving reality. So it's just a kind of, what was your question again specifically?
I was just wondering if you think of yourself as a mindful person, but I realized
yes.
I said there was like, yeah, that's putting someone in a box, isn't it?
Well,
which is not the idea.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of the Buddha, and the basic essence of, well, among the basic essence of Buddhism is a call to mindfulness. And I also, once upon a time, studied Gurdjieff and Ouspensky and those gentlemen. And it's the same thing. It's about conscious living, being very mindful and aware and awake of how you're living your life and why you're making the choices that you're making. And so I went along like that for a long time and found great benefit in it. But like anything else, the point is ultimately integration. So whatever your idea, your philosophy of life, you still have to find a way to actually integrate it into the reality that you also have to pay respect to.
Mm-hmm.
So mindfulness then, if its character is too much of an extreme, it becomes its own albatross, and it's something that then you have to work to balance when mindfulness is more of a mechanical response to reality as opposed to a natural response. And ultimately, we're only trying to get to our most natural responses and not be judgmental of them, not be ashamed of them, and learn to love and accept ourselves as we're built.
Mm. I suppose I brought that up because you were talking about really letting yourself go when you're in your creative process in writing music. And so it just occurred to me that that kind of fits. I just wondered if that continued outside the studio as well, because it seems to me like your approach to life is your approach to your art.
Yes.
Because it really, listening to your record, and I mean this as the hugest compliment, your latest record, it just really sounds like you don't give a fuck what anyone thinks about what you're making. And that's, to me, such a wonderful freedom. It feels free, you know? It feels like you're just expressing yourself however you like.
Well, you have to claim that territory for yourself if you want to have enough canvas to paint on.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do it. And you also have to develop the same attitude towards your own judgments. You have to also know when not to give a fuck about what you're doing until you finish doing what you're doing. Because, again, sometimes you're just a midwife. Sometimes you're an actual creator. You're sitting there and you're creating that which will become real, literally like a sculptor, and you're chiseling away, and you can say, okay, I wrote that piece of music, or I wrote that book. Mm-hmm. There are other times when you're just a midwife and you're delivering a source of energy that's coming from one dimension into this one. And that's when you kind of have to suspend judgment until the baby is delivered and not judge it while it's being delivered. Because if you're not the one creating it, then it's very wise to shut up and let it be what it is until you start passing commentary on it. Mm-hmm. So you have to have that discipline with yourself as an artist, because you're always going to have as a nemesis the threat of your own high standards. You've always got a stern voice judge sitting in a wig and a black robe from a high position, pointing his finger down at you and telling you what you should have done or what you maybe should have considered. So there's always that voice to contend with. And so it's just a matter of knowing when to just block everything out and create. Also, because it's not like it's brain surgery. It's not like somebody's going to die if I don't fucking realize the thing that's, you know, driving me in that moment. It's not like I'm creating a code that's going to like shut down like, you know, internet systems or anything like that. So, you know, I know it's only rock and roll, but I like it. You know what I mean?
I love all those analogies. It's so interesting. I've done 35 episodes of this podcast so far, and the reason for doing it is to have an excuse to talk to lots of different artists so that I can learn from them and be inspired by them, and we can share stories and things. It's very, very selfish. But also it's interesting because everyone has a different way of describing the inner critic, so the guy in the wig wagging his finger at you, as you just described.
Yes.
And the different ways of pulling songs out of the air, like when a song just appears and you don't know where it's from, the idea of channeling it, of being a conduit between this thing in the air and then this thing being a reality. And then, yeah, the sculpting and the chiseling. It's so interesting that we're all going through very similar experiences, obviously with very different backgrounds and approaches and different voices and all that, but that there's such a common ground as well.
Well, because the greater art form, which our other art forms are embodied within, is the making a masterpiece of our life.
Yes.
Me being an artist is just literally a reflection of the fact that what we are doing in life is taking this clay and we're making a life. We're making an art form as we go that we leave behind, and it's called a legacy. But let me also say that I've always had a tremendous appreciation for you Brits and your love facilitative language. It's always been a great inspiration to me. But on the negative side of it, you guys use it to beat the shit out of yourselves. and so maybe the price of, you know, it's like the French, maybe the price of having such a beautiful language is, you know, the temptation to be, you know, basically jerks, if you will, or in the way that other people are approached. But you know, one of the fascinating things about your culture is the kind of how much of a art form you've made out of the particular form of psychological self-abuse that your culture does engage in. Now, I say that to say this. You mentioned how selfish it was that you use your podcast as an opportunity to engage yourself more fully.
Yes.
And so, first of all, this presumes that the word selfish, of course, only has one slanted connotation, and it's a negative connotation. Mm-hmm. Okay. When in fact, to be selfish can also mean to be self-possessed, and to be self-aware is certainly a strong sign on the level of as far as evolution is concerned. And then to be smart enough to then take something that you love and make it work for you is also a utility. Mm-hmm. That's not just selfish. That's really fucking smart. That's really, really smart.
You are calling me on my bullshit today. I love it. Because I was just being sarcastic. Yeah, it's lazy to be sarcastic, I think. I think you're right.
But it is a feature of the British character that they're almost afraid to go two sentences without somehow bashing themselves or using their language against them. And it's amusing at first, but at some point, it just becomes something that you just want to point out to your friends that, you know, it's like I have a daughter who's British, and you guys say sorry a tremendous amount.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we do.
And so it's just a kind of trying to call your attention to it so that you can see sometimes how it creates a self-defeating paradigm, as because words, there's a reason why we spell words, because words create spells. So it's just to say that the first step in cleaning up your mind is cleaning up your language. Because your language and your mind influence one another greatly, as the first spark that then makes the rest of the reality starts like become the way, the ripple in the waves of time, just as it would on a pond.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's one, it is a cultural thing. And it's very interesting to me meeting more American people when, as I started touring. I used to tour a lot with different bands around the world. And I'm not going to say sorry about that. I nearly did it, but I'm not going to. But then when I started meeting more American people, there's a directness, which I think some people can perceive as rudeness sometimes, but I actually really respect, because it's not rude to in the moment figure out what you need to have or get or whatever, so that you can do the thing you're there to do.
It's called intelligence. In fact,
intelligence, right?
That's what intelligence means, is your ability and how quickly you're able to adapt to the circumstances that you find yourself in. It's got nothing to do with how well you can remember quotes by Shakespeare. That is a part of intellect, and that's a part. There's nothing wrong with that. But actual intelligence is just merely how well you land and can stay on your feet when circumstances dictate that you have to. But, you know, look, the basic difference between Americans and Brits is that we're both shits, but we don't apologize for it.
Yes.
You know, we just, you know, we kind of have that naivete, that kind of, that the rudeness won't really, really catch up to us. But, you know, at the same time, we are a young nation. We're not even yet 250 years old. And so the sight of a country that's not yet 250 years old dominating and having a say over how the cultures transpire from nations that are like much, much, much older than they are. You know, it's just kind of been an interesting experience in the last, you know, a few centuries. But anyway, we digress.
Oh, this is all about digressing. Don't worry about it. I love your new album.
Thank you so much.
Would you like to talk about that a little bit and tell us what's going on there? Because it's a double album. It's called Pandora's Playhouse. I know there's mythological stories on there. There's a wonderful collaboration with the Avalanches on there too, with Vashti Bunyan singing, a sample of her singing. There's a whole load of stuff going on there, but there's definitely, I have no problem with there being a whole load of stuff going on there. I want there to be a whole load of stuff going on everything. And it's wonderful. It fits together so beautifully.
Thank you.
It's really hard to pick out favorite songs. There's so much stuff going on there. There's so many interesting moments lyrically that really cut through me. There's a line, "In my memory, I forgot to remember me." And I just sat there going, oh, wow. Had to keep replaying that bit again and again. There's just so much in there. So with an album like that, that's so wide ranging and there's such a lot going on, how on earth do you as the artist sum that up to explain to someone what that is?
Well, it's always a bit of a challenge because you can become glib after a while of having the experience of talking about it. But I haven't really gotten to that point yet. So first of all, it's always, look, for an artist, people are people. And even when they're sometimes trying to compliment you, they can say embarrassing things. So you don't really listen so much to how people are trying to come to terms with what the work means. You just are moved by the fact it means anything at all. You know, because of course, it would be naive to say I'm sitting there just, you know, creating in the dark and I don't know who it's going to hit. Well, I know it's going to hit someone because I have been at my craft almost all of my life and have been known for doing it for the greater portion of my adult life so far. So it's not as if I don't have an understanding that sometimes I'm working with energies and concepts and continuums that might have some effect on other people's experience as well. Mm-hmm. Because as obvious as it is to say, well, we are, the artist is the person too, and the art form is to translate the emotions and the events and the things that happen to you that you're quite certain others can relate to, and just mm-hmm. filter that through yourself in the hopes that it remains something that can be easily identifiable as an emotion that others, you know, have felt or experienced, that they understand, yeah, I know what this guy is talking about. But it's also the unwritten language of music, where there are things that you don't even have to say. The frequencies and the vibrations that you chose of the chords and the colors, they are already speaking their own language. And so, you know, it's, as you very well know, when you're taking on a project like this, you become that for a while. And it's never a light experience. I mean, in the sense that you might have all of your materials, you might be ready. So all the physical matter might be there, but you still have to go and filter through the emotional energy, the spiritual mm-hmm. energy, the psychology of the experience. You know, the fact that what I've learned in working with these characters from mythology was, first of all, I don't really believe in mythology. I just believe that past a certain point of us being able to verify with written records certain of our human experiences, we don't call it history anymore. We just call it mythology. Mm. And, you know, for centuries, we lived oral traditions, all of our tribes. So just because some of the details might be extraneous and they might be, you know, blown up or exaggerated, doesn't mean that the core truth of mythology isn't the truth of our ancestors and their experiences and where we've come from. So what I've learned is that when you're working with figures like Pandora, Prometheus, these energies come back to life. You energize these energies, and you have to answer for these energies. So it's like, for example, if I name a project and I call that project Beethoven, then it would be very, very unlikely that the core energy that is Beethoven wouldn't at least poke its head in my studio and see what the fuck is going on with this guy using my vibration and using my name to further some expression that he feels he has to express. So I've learned that when you take on Pandora, Pandora represents the spirit of the feminine and divine spirit of the world. Mm. So, you know, you have to be careful, because you call upon these energies, and at some point, these energies are there. These energies are monitoring, working with you or whatever, because you're evoking their vibration. You're evoking their presence. Why wouldn't they? And of course, if they feel that you're disrespecting them, they're going to basically cause problems for your project. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they feel that you are approaching with a respect towards furthering the story of the narrative of who they are, then I believe you start to get some help, you know, and synchronicities and nice, wonderful moments of inspiration as well.
Yeah.
So, that's basically all I can say, is that a lot of things were brought to bear on this project. The first thing to understand is that from the very beginning of Post-Millennium Rock, it was conceived that instead of me continuing to just write the best songs that I could, I wanted a greater challenge, and to write songs that also could hold their own as a narrative within each album project for the theater. So that, you know, either in concert, if you just wanted to do that album, or if you want to transfer it to a musical theater and then do that album, that they all came with their own self-contained storylines that then fit into the larger universe of the Zoathlon, that is the world that I created, in which Prometheus and Pandora and the Sphinx and all of these people have their, and these beings and the Zugebrian Time Lords, they have their place in this world. This kind of Tolkien world that I was projecting for, to give myself something else besides just, okay, I'm going to write some more songs. I needed a greater challenge. So Pandora's Playhouse is basically the final chapter and the continuation of the predecessor project, which was Prometheus and Pandora. And even when I was finishing Prometheus and Pandora, I kind of still understood that until I finished Pandora's Playhouse, I didn't get the monkey completely off my back.
Mm-hmm.
So the best thing I can say on Pandora's Playhouse for it on my behalf is that it finally got the monkey off my back, and literally it feels like the end of an era for post-millennium rock, and I can kind of then follow it as it goes into its next personification.
Mm. So how does that feel physically and emotionally, having this album finished, ready to go out into the world?
Well, initially, you're going to experience postpartum depression, which is entirely normal when you've been incubating and living with something for 2 or 3 years, when you've been accumulating data, you've been accumulating experience, impressions, you've been, you know, scribbling away furiously, you've been, you know, tying in your storylines and your concepts, you've been spending time with the instruments, your musicians, you've been corralling all of this data into some usable emotional form and shaping it and going through all of the psychological experiencing all of the psychological ramifications of bearing so much energy for such a concentrated period of time that consumes your focus. When you discharge that energy, it's the closest thing that I, as a man, will ever know to what it's like to give birth to something that's been in your body, nourishing your body and feeding from your body, that's all of a sudden no longer a part of your internal mechanism. So initially, it's depressing and disorienting. And then, of course, in that state of low gravity comes all the doubts and all the concerns as to whether or not you paid enough attention, or whether you, you know, did you really give it 120%, or did you just give it 99.9%?
Mm.
All those silly questions that artists must bear, because that's part of the process and the taxes we pay on the great opportunity we have to actually be artists in this world and even dare earn a living from it.
Yeah. And would this be the time you would normally be planning tours and things? Do you do a lot of live stuff in normal times?
In normal times, it was certainly part of the tradition to basically go out and face the music that you created.
Mm.
But one of the blessings of the COVID era is just, if any can be found, is certainly that it's allowed all of us to get off the hamster wheel, swinging from vine to vine, from tree to tree, and just kind of reestablishing for ourselves what's feasible, what works, what fits the needs of our life. Because just because I make records doesn't mean I'm any more obliged than a painter when I'm releasing my work to the world that I necessarily feel obliged to have to do anything more than just to ring the dinner bell and say, come get it. Unless, of course, you choose to engage more. And there certainly have been times in my life when all I've wanted to do was just get the record out, let people know it was there, and just move on to the next thing that I wanted to establish, which is usually the next record. As I've alluded to before, with Pandora's Playhouse, I needed to take a break because there have been opportunities that have been mushrooming for me for a few years that I have been postponing, because I understood that until Pandora's Playhouse was finished, then that particular chapter of post-millennium rock and my life weren't yet finished. And so now, you know, things such as books, documentaries, a couple of years ago, right before COVID, I were offered an opportunity to do a musical based on my songs by the National Theater of Italy.
Mm.
And I was really delighted because it just felt like it was time for me to start thinking about new vistas, while at the same time, it validated what I had been saying, that the very beginning of post-millennium rock was meant to also be for the theater.
Mm.
So we had agreed that my life story itself would be too depressing for theater, because my life story is a great story. It's actually would make a great film. But a film experience is different when you can sit home in your underwear and your socks, you know, smoke a spliff, you know, scratch your balls, whatever. And you can take a person through individual, you know, moods and moments, because they still wind up in the same place they've started. Whereas, of course, if you're asking someone to come out, take a shower, get in some clean clothes, you know, look spiffy, and spend a few extra pennies at the theater, you want to make sure that they leave the theater humming and singing in an upbeat mood. And that's the least you can do for them. I mean, you're enticing people to come out of their cubby holes, you know, and out of our caves, you know, and to go sit in this place where we gather together. So I was just very delighted that I had that opportunity waiting. Then it kind of snowballed so that other corporations got hold of that idea and said, hey, well, if it doesn't work out with the National Theater, we like to do it ourselves. So there was a kind of pressure around Pandora's Playhouse because I kind of had been using it as the excuse to postpone all of these other eventualities.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, now where as I would be usually turning my attention to touring and things of that nature, now I'm trying to see how to utilize, of course, we'll utilize live streaming from my studio to accommodate what some of touring would have in the past, as well as me beginning to move and put things in place now so that I can start to have Prometheus and Pandora will actually be the name of the whole musical of my songs.
And it's incredible.
It will use that narrative to basically explain my life and just what goes on in life in general.
Mm. Yeah, well, as you were describing all of the characters, I was thinking, how could this be brought in a different way, in a visual way? So that's exactly how, isn't it? With that kind of show, that's the perfect venue for it.
Yes. Well, the thing is this, again, from the very beginning of Angels and Vampires, it was meant to be engulfed into a larger stage performance in the narrative of the myth, which by the time we got to Prometheus and Pandora, we realized that's what the story will be based around, because again, this is a theater and a love story never hurts. And it also has the advantage of using characters that culturally we're all familiar with. If not consciously, at least subconsciously. So you're already just working with material that you reawaken within people, that it makes the story that much more immediate. Because once again, we're talking about our ancestors. And, you know, I remember a line from one of my favorite films of all time, Amadeus, when Mozart's character intones and asks one of the elders why they have to always keep writing operas about the same shit over and over again, about the same dead heroes. And the answer was because those dead heroes are still alive. And that's, for me, I love being able to work with this material, because Prometheus for me is a figure with whom many artists can relate.
Yeah. And so when we were talking before about the different ways that songs come, so there's we talked about two different ways. You mentioned the one where I said the conduit, you didn't say it that way, but where things
are coming. The
sculptor. Thank you. The sculptor. There's a sculptor one, and then there's the one where the thing's just, it's flashing into you.
Yeah, your midwife.
The midwife. Thank you. So between the sculptor and the midwife, how much of your latest album and the series of albums preceding it that create that whole world, how much of that came from the midwife part of it, and how much came from the sculptor, would you say? So like the initial flash of an idea.
I'm mainly a midwife artist. Mainly, but what I mainly, it's not that I don't trust the sculptor. I do. I just don't like to overwork the sculptor, because the sculptor has too much experience and has too much understanding.
Yeah.
So the sculptor is less likely to just to come up with some crazy shit just because it's crazy. The sculptor likes to understand what he's doing.
Yeah.
The midwife just takes it as it comes and then holds it and goes, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's cool. Yeah. And then from there, you finish tweaking it with your experience. Now, for example, if I have a project and I have the bulk of the project and it's been midwifed, then I may say to myself as a publisher, I think I'm missing a song about Prometheus. Or, there's a song about Pegasus that this could use to fill out and fatten the narrative. That's when the sculptor will go, okay, let's, you know, is this a piano-based song? Is this a guitar-based song? And then I'll just go to one of those instruments and I'll start creating. But that's usually to, like, fill in the blanks of the process that's largely been midwifed.
Yeah.
I've come up with a lot of sculpted stuff that I've really, really, really loved. Because, of course, at this point, I do have years of experience. But I don't tend to lead with the sculptor. I tend to first wait for the midwife to come and give me what the vibe and the spirit that I will be approaching and accommodating. And then, again, then I can work around that if I need to sculpt.
Yeah. It's just as you were describing, again, this expansive world, I was thinking, it doesn't sound like there's a spreadsheet here.
I just thought of an example. Perfect example. The last two songs I recorded, one was a perfect example of being midwife, and the other was a perfect example of the sculptor. Because I had finished the project, or thought I had finished the project, and me and my wonderful wife and family decided to go to the mountains for catch our breath for a few days. And so I went to the mountains. I got up early one morning. I took a nice smoke and exhaled. And this song came, Don't Bust My Balls.
I love that one. Such a good one.
So it was a song that came. I thought, oh, cool. I like that. I'll put that away for the next project or for a future project. It became really clear at the mountain's insistence that this wasn't something I could sit on top of. And I mean, you have to know your process well enough to know what you can store away in your files and what you have to immediately act upon. And so after first getting over my disappointment that I was going to have to go into the studio again, because it was obvious, no, this project is not finished. You need this song. Okay. So, but I'm a kind of, I don't think workaholic would be the right word. I'm a workaholic. So even if it's my studio, even if I don't have to pay for the time in the same way, the idea of me going into the studio just for one song became, that's not the way I work. So I figured, fuck, I need another song. And then I remember I had her kiss, but it wasn't finished because I just thought, oh, one day I'll finish this. It's a nice piece of music. I like this. I'll finish it one day. And when I realized that I was going to have another song, that's when the sculptor sat down and I took her kiss. And then there was another piece of a song that I hadn't finished from a while ago. Which was a completely different song. And so the sculptor says, yeah, I need a second song. So it's going to be her kiss. I'm going to finish this. And then I'm going to take this other song that I didn't finish. And I'm going to merge the two together and stitch it up. And it's just going to be called Her Kiss. So that's a good example of those last two songs. One was midwives, where I'm literally just taking dictation and following instructions from the muse, and Her Kiss, where I basically use my experience as a arranger to make something out of two previous things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing those examples. That's really interesting. I think, we talk about this kind of stuff in so many different ways on this podcast, and it's just lovely to hear your take on it. Really interesting.
You're welcome.
Do you have any favourite songs you've written? You must have done hundreds by now. So I know that's a big question, but do you have any particular ones that, for whatever reason, are your favourites?
That's always a tough question, because it doesn't matter whether you're talking about my music or my favorite 10 songs from some other
person. Oh, yeah, that's a hard one too.
It's still something that can change from day to day, whatever those answers are. And of course, whatever answer you give, because often the answer you're stuck with, and, you know, it's always tough. And it's, even though it's a cliche that I'm sure you've heard before, they're all my babies. And so, you know, they're all these little eggs that you've given birth to. And precisely because I don't keep up with them, they often come back to me, let's say, as adults or as mature beings that I haven't had to hear or listen to for quite a long time, enough to give me space and appreciation from whatever my judgments were about them at the time. And you're really able to appreciate that. You know, look, it's very difficult for me to answer that question.
That's okay.
But the greatest privilege that I have at this point in my life is to realize how many songs I've written and published. I've written thousands, but I've actually written and published, I guess, close to 300. And for me, I was raised by, you know, in the working class, and the value of work and work ethic is always been a part of my nature. And, you know, that is my proudest achievement, is surviving a ruthless business with my dignity intact, most of my sense, and having created a body of work that I can honestly say that I'm proud to have my name attached to, and that, you know, has the respect of my peers, which, again, regardless of whether you're a songwriter or a plumber or a car mechanic, the value of the respect you get from your peers is among the highest that you can expect to anticipate when you go into anything.
I'm glad you have a good relationship with your back catalogue, because I think it would be a real devastating thing if all of the machinations of the bullshit music industry stuff that you've been through had taken that away, because that stuff's yours, you know, and that just that would have upset me to hear.
It certainly did take it away for a while, but that's, again, that's just, you either survive it or it kills you. I survived it. Many of my peers didn't, and so part of what happened to me when I was making Prometheus and Pandora, the previous project, was that four of my iconic friends died. Tom Petty, in no particular order, of course. It kind of sounds facetious to say, but Tom Petty, David Bowie, George Michael, and Prince all passed within the time that I was undertaking the project, Prometheus and Pandora. And it just... whatever my beefs were against the life that I had struggled to survive before, I think the deaths of those four iconic and great artists, who had all done for me something of great value, personally and professionally, you have to reevaluate your relationship to your life, because, you know, the great meditation of our youth is our immortality and the truth of our immortality. That's what most of our youth is inadvertently focused on, is that we are immortal beings. But the mature portion of our meditation is on our mortality. And we pass through a certain gate, whereby, having verified that, yes, we are immortal beings, we now enter the understanding of our mortality and how precious and finite is our mortality. And all of the attitudes that carry us through the storm is like unto the example where there's a priest and a disciple who are carrying a boat, and then they cross the river. Then they continue walking when they get to the other side. And at some point, the Buddhist priest turns around and he sees that the disciple is still carrying the boat on his head. And he asks him, "Why are you still carrying the boat? We've already crossed the river." And so the point is, you can continue carrying the boat if you wish, because it's your boat. Mm-hmm. Fuck if you're going to just drop it. You paid for it. You know, but you also have the option to say, he's right. The boat served the purpose for which it was built. I don't have to carry it anymore.
Yeah. That's blowing my mind. That's such a clever way of putting it. Wow.
So when they died, it certainly allowed me to confront the issues that were still vexing me. And that I had been holding on to because I'm a soldier. It's like I'm a warrior. I'm like this. I am assigned my post. And until I am relieved by the Lord of my post, I will guard my post with my life, because that's my assignment. And I'm those kind of bitches. So, you know, but it was like an angel appearing and saying, "Well done, your resistance has taken you where you need to be, but you're there now, and you no longer need to hold on to this. And it would be in your best interest to just let it go so that you can embrace all that your life has created and lose the bitterness of having to hold an area of resistance and resentment against an abusive past." Mm-hmm. That just because the past was abusive didn't mean that I couldn't take from that past and bring into the future those things which were not abusive and were of great value.
Mm-hmm. And so how has life felt since then, since that moment?
Well, it kind of felt like learning to fly again. I'm a Pisces, but my rising sign is Capricorn, and Capricorns are mountain goats, so they're always climbing. That's their nature. They climb. And so they can be very stubborn, obstinate, and ambitious bitches. And but the problem is that sometimes they have to be reminded that they've run out of mountain, and that it isn't their fault that their instinct to climb doesn't really take them any further than they need to be anymore. It's just that when all you've known is climb, 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 even when you no longer are obliged to climb, you know no other way. And so it takes a while to reprogram yourself that your climbing days, or your great days of great climbing, are behind you, and that you've reached your destination.
That can be very hard to know, can't it?
Well, especially if you're a wanderer, if you've spent your whole life wandering, you know, how do you know when it's time to stop? Just because you have stuff placed around you that you cherished doesn't mean that that's in the past been sufficient enough to hold you from wandering off to the next, you know, scenario.
I think there's a big problem in the sort of artistic musical life where when you start out, and this is on any level, I've always been independent, so I'm talking about, you know, being tiny, unknown, or, you know, in other situations too. But everything is about, like you say, climbing. You're supposed to climb, climb, climb. And then there's no kind of discussion about what happens about having a lifetime career in this kind of thing. So you can't always be climbing. There's going to be dips. It doesn't mean that you're no good. It just means that it's impossible to climb forever at a steady pace. And I think the idea that you could have a lifelong career as an artist and a musician making music for decades isn't something that people kind of plan for. And maybe you shouldn't be planning for all these things anyway, because it's not about spreadsheets and goal lists and things like that.
That's why you can't plan on a music career. It has to be a calling. Mm-hmm. You literally have to feel that the voice of God has reached down into the recesses of your dark heart and said, "I call forth now, you know, an artist," because you absolutely have to be out of your mind to want to be involved in this crazy shit. It's just the reality of what the situation is. So unless you literally have been given no other choice by karma, by fate, you know, I'm asked all the time, oh, what would you say to new artists who are entering the music business? My answer is always, run, turn around right now while you have a chance and get the hell out of here now.
And
if you're still stupid enough after that to stick around, well, then welcome.
Welcome
to the madhouse.
Yeah. I love that you're so independent now and have been for a while, you know, and not just artistically, but also you're putting your records out, which means you're not beholden to anybody, which means that you can do things exactly how you want. And I do things the same way on a much smaller scale. I'm doing that British thing again of being self-deprecating. I apologize. Sure. Now I'm saying sorry because it's just everything all at once. So I suppose what I'm asking is, if someone said to you, what advice would you give to someone who wants an artistic career? Would you really say run if there was the option for them to do stuff independently and maintain all of that control creatively and in business?
It's a hard life. You have to be hopelessly in love with it.
Yeah.
It's just the only way. It's like, if it weren't for love and the threat of sex, men and women would almost never have anything to do with one another because we're just so different. And yet, once you get bitten by that thing, it's bigger than you. You surrender to it. It's a spell and you follow it.
Mm.
It's a rabbit hole and you just jump into it and hope that, you know, there is at least some humor to be found on the other side. But first, let's dispel a couple of myths. An artist who follows the muse is never really completely independent. Of course, it sounds that way. You're saying independent relative to the fact that you don't have corporate executives dictating what your movements are.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not really independent when you're following your muse. You're following something that you're listening to, and you're listening to it faithfully. And you still have your own artistic standards and expectations that exist as another person. It's not as if you are totally free of standards and things of that nature and at being admonished by the inner voice if you're not taking it seriously enough or if you're taking it perhaps too seriously. Mm-hmm. What you're free of is the contingencies that happens when you have a corporate committee of people who can change between the time that they signed your project to the time that your project comes out. One group of people is telling you to do this. Another group of people is advising that you do that. It takes an incredibly strong and stubborn person who will often be vastly criticized for being able to withstand all of that and still come out intact with what their vision for themselves is as an artist. It's not as if Picasso didn't have to answer to his inner Picasso. He just didn't have to listen to a bunch of people, interchangeable faces, telling him that he should stick to bowls of fruit because bowls of fruit were what was selling best last year.
Yeah.
Okay. So, or Picasso, listen, nobody gets these women that you draw with like four faces. And this one woman, what the hell is going on here? So, but clearly he was following something. Clearly he was not independent of something that was driving and molding his vision that he was answering to. So It is just to say that you remove the trivial aspect out of your process, out of the way of your process as an artist. What the aspect that is most real, editing and those things, they only grow. I've only grown as an editor as I've gotten more mature as an artist. And so just make it clear that you're always answering to something and you're answering to something that you presume to be higher or parallel to what your experience is that you've developed a great trust in. And then while learning, you have to block out the voices of those people who see you for the value of what you're worth to them.
And that's a very different kind of value that you're worth to them compared to an audience member.
Yes, of course.
Obviously. Do you have a sense of who your audience is these days and whether they are people who have traveled with you along this road for a long time?
I've always kept my distance from that. I try not to be a careerist in any possible way. I see less of it being a career as my work, as this is what I do. But I was very aware of, at some point, there being a distinct rupture between those who were with me initially and then those who only really discovered me in the era of the internet. So there is a portion, a suitable portion, a large portion of my audience that I've earned in the last 20 years that were not necessarily aware of me before, and many of whom made it clear that they didn't care, that they didn't care about what that was. Because at one point there was just a little bit of a turf war between the people who came with me initially and those who discovered me in my Sonanda Maitreya years. So, but time smooths all of that out, you know, and ultimately it's just kind of a wonderful thing to be able to see people, and you then might see a woman who was 15 when you were first made known to her, who now brings her mother and her, and then who brings also her daughter. And you might see just three generations of a beautiful face looking at you and thanking you for what you've done. And again, that's really the value of it, because, you know, when you can see something that brings, you know, people together or families together, it just helped bring different tribes together. I do take some pride in the fact that I've been told that the number of people of bi and multiracial descent that have doubled and tripled since my generation came through, that I feel like I had something also to do with. And I have also just received so many notes and letters from people who basically said that they were conceived to my music. So, again, I don't think there's a greater compliment an artist can be given, is that your work actually brought human people into the world.
That's incredible.
But yeah, that's the greatest compliment any artist, any songwriter or a person can get, is that they actually have helped procreate the planet. You know, so it's about that at this point for me, love. I don't really try to pay too much more attention to it. I don't take anything for granted. And if I go out on stage and I see anybody there at all who still gives a shit, I'm just very happy and grateful to the Lord that I can still actually put food on my table doing the thing that I most wanted to do when I first heard the Beatles as a 2-year-old boy in East Orange, New Jersey.
Wonderful. Well, look, that's a really beautiful way to end our conversation, unless there's anything else you'd like to throw in.
No, I'm fine. I appreciate this very much. I love that Laura is actually Laura, which means it's Italian for the soul. The name in Italian would be spelled L apostrophe Aura. I mean, that's the essence of what it means. Laura, the aura.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's always awesome to be talking to the aura. Thank you, love.
Okay, well, thank you so, so much. It was wonderful to speak to you. Best of luck with the album. It's really great.
Thank you. I appreciate your support of it. God bless
you. Of course. Thank you. Wasn't he great? Do make sure you go and support Sonanda by listening to his new album Pandora's Playhouse. And as always, I've made a deluxe show notes page on my website at penfriend.rocks/Sonanda. If you're new to my musical world, please visit my website penfriend.rocks for music, videos, writing and more podcast episodes. And hit subscribe in your preferred podcasting app or even on YouTube so you can hear next week's conversation. There's such a lovely community building around this podcast, so thank you for being part of that. My work is made possible by the Correspondence Club, a friendly group of generous patrons of the arts. Thank you so much to every member. I'll be back next Wednesday with another deep conversation about creativity, grit, and determination. So I hope to catch you then. Take care.